Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 3rd, 2010, and this is show number 239. Well, I hope you all had a safe and happy New Year's celebration. We had a blast. We had about 35 people over, and, well, luckily crazy listener James was in London, so he didn't show up, so that was good. But after Christmas, I got a great surprise from Steve that I think you'll really appreciate. He got me personalized license plates that say Podfeet. How cool is that? I just love them. It really, really makes me happy. It just absolutely delights me. Every time I look at my car, I'm like, yay! So I've got my Apple sticker and my Podfeet license plates. I'm all ready to go. So this is funny, though. The day we picked him up, Justin Byrne, who does the Mac Crack podcast with David Shortle, Justin was here actually in town. And he had been here a year ago to see us, but he was in town over from Ireland and was coming over to see us. So anyway, I didn't bother giving him new directions or even remind him of what my address was. I figured he'd ask me if he didn't have it. Anyway, we pull into the garage from being out to pick up the new license plates, and right as we walk in the doorbell rings, and there's Justin at the door. He proudly announced, "I found the place," as he walked in. And I, of course, asked him how he accomplished that. He said that he drove until he got close, and he was waiting at a light, consulting the GPS on his iPod Touch and trying to figure out which way to turn, when he looked up and he saw the car in front of him said, "Podfeet" on the back. So he just followed us home. Isn't that great? I suppose it's great till crazy listener James starts following me around town, too. All right, I know a ton of you are making the pilgrimage to San Francisco for Macworld in February, so we've set up a group calendar so we can try to set up a NoSillaCast meetup. If you're interested in being able to add your travel plans to the calendar, shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com, and I'll give you write privileges to the calendar. I embedded the calendar in the show notes so you can see when everyone else is coming and going. You do have to flip over to February to see Macworld, so don't be confused if it looks blank when you first bring up the webpage. I also put a link in the right sidebar to the calendar so you could get to it quickly without having to remember, which show did she embed the calendar in anyway? The main thing is, I sure hope to see a lot of you there. By now, you've probably figured out that I have a car waxing problem. I love to wax cars. I clay them first, then I use a cleaner wax, then a nice Carnauba. Finish it off with some tire black to set off the finish of the car. Just heaven. I've been known to wax the cars of friends, employees, and even strangers' cars. Robert Lockman of Photography in the Mac went from strangers to friends when I waxed his car while he took photographs of me. That was really fun. That was the first time I'd done a complete stranger's car. That was hilarious. Anyway, I enjoy waxing cars because, at least for my own cars, it makes them look fantastic well beyond their evident age. I wax all four of our cars, Steve's, mine, Lindsay's, and Kyle's, and it's great fun to have people surprised at how old these cars actually are. One problem I've been having, though, is that both Lindsay and Kyle's cars have been getting awful water spots on them from sprinklers near where they park. I have tried every weapon in my arsenal, and those darn spots leave a white haze on the pure black of their cars. It's driving me crazy. I mean, they can feel good, and they look good from a distance, but you get up close, and you can see all these water spots. Oh, yesterday, I washed my car, washed Kyle's car, I actually vacuumed my car, and then I went to the store to buy yet another type of cleaner polisher from Meguiar's to try and attack these water spots. But it wasn't having much effect. I was working and working and working, and those spots weren't coming out. Now, I got to tell you, I don't mind doing a lot of work on a car as long as when I'm done, it looks really good. What I hate is doing all this work and then it looks like crap. Well, anyway, so here I am working and working and working this special cleaner trying to get the water spots out, and it's not working. Well, right then, our neighbors Carrie and Mike came over to visit because they'd just gotten a new Acura RDX just like Steve's. Strangely enough, we hadn't actually met them before because in L.A., you just really don't walk over and say hi like in the rest of the natural world. Turns out they moved in 3 years ago and we'd never even said hi before. Anyway, luckily they did come over because as we chatted, I found out that Mike is pretty into his cars and he kind of feels badly that he doesn't wash his cars as often as we do. Well, on a lark, I asked him if he had any ideas of how to get those darn water spots out. He looked through my stuff and declared that I should try using an orbital polisher. I told him I'd tried one years ago, and all I managed to do was fling wax all over the place. It was on the windows, it was on the ground, it was all over me, it was a big mess. He assured me that he had just the thing, and he trotted back over to his house. He came back with this giant toolbox, and he started pulling out all these toys. He showed me that he has two different types of pads for his orbital polisher. One was really rough, and the other one was a bit smoother. He brought out some compound, and that made me really nervous. I mean, usually compounds, when you got, you know, you got a serious problem, and you're going to scratch the heck out of that finish when you use it. But he said I may get some swirls with this combination, but that I could wax them out later with a softer pad and some carnauba wax. So first, he put just the teeniest amount of compound on that rough pad, and I mean teeniest amount, just a tiny little bit. Oh, first he squirted some lubricant on it first, which I didn't understand that, but oh well, I'll do as I'm told. And anyway, he puts this teeny little bit of compound on it, and then without turning it on, he just kind of started smearing it around on a section of the car. This way, when he did turn it on, it didn't send the glop flying all over the place. He's a smart fella. Anyway, he spent about 3 minutes going over this very small section with the orbital polisher, and by then it was pretty much dried, and we could actually rub it off with a towel right away. And guess what? The water spots were gone. Yay! I was so excited. Anyway, for a while I did the Tom Sawyer thing and let him do the work, but pretty soon I couldn't resist, and I had to take over playing with his orbital polisher. Now remember, I'd already washed two cars, but I spent another 3.5 hours using that orbital polisher. I'm telling you, if the sun hadn't gone down, I would have gone on even longer. I could basically barely stand up when I was done. It took two Advils to just straighten me back up. But I gotta tell you, I was in heaven. I finally got those darn water spots out. Now I can't wait until Lindsay comes home so I can fix them on her car too. If you want to see the evidence of my labors, be sure to check out the show notes for some photographs of the cars. Now, I have to warn you, these were taken on January 2nd, and I'm wearing shorts and a t-shirt, so don't holler at me like Louis Trapani did when he first saw them. Remember, this is, by the way, a 10-year-old car when you see how amazing it looks.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What do I... What is...
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, it's time for that part of the show where you get to ask that dumb question that you think everybody else knows the answer to, but, you know, you feel kind of dumb asking it, but you're allowed to ask it here, and there is no mocking, unless you ask a question that's too hard, and like Gazman's last week, and then you get mocked like crazy. So, keep it simple, guys. Anyway, we have a letter for Dumb Question Corner this week. Hi, Allison. Happy New Year. Anyway, I was listening to your show the other day. I wanted to tell you how much I really enjoyed Steve's review of his new video cam. I think it's a really good review and really unique in the sense that we learned so much about your personal life in the process as well. And I think Steve has a great podcasting voice, crisp tones, and clear pronunciation. Really enjoyed it. Well, I'm really glad you like Steve's review. We had a really good time doing it. Felt very natural, even though he had some pretty detailed notes that we were working off of. I think you'll see more of these over time because he's getting a lot of fan mail. In fact, I'm a little tired of hearing how much everybody liked his stuff. But anyway, we are hoping to retire maybe someday, and we like doing these kind of geeky things together. I think you'll see more of these over the coming years. So anyway, back to the letter. I would like to submit a dumb question. Why do computers have DVD region restrictions while my DVD player doesn't? By the way, this is such a pain in the neck as I can't play DVDs I bought from overseas on my laptop. Great job. Thanks for a fantastic show that I look forward to every week. Thanks, Alvin from Singapore. Well, Alvin, you can blame the media companies for DVD region restrictions, or perhaps you might choose to blame the DVD pirates for that. It's a combination of the two. The fear is that the piracy that's rampant in one country, say China, which is in Region 6, could spread over to the U.S., for example, in Region 1, where it's far less prevalent of a practice. By keeping the regions separate, the problem can't spread as easily. It also lets them control the release dates and the pricing. You will notice that none of the reasons for region codes are to enhance the experience in any way for you, the consumer, who is paying them for these DVDs. Well, it sounds like you have a DVD player that's a little bit unique. It's what they call region-free, but most of us don't have that luxury. In most cases, DVD players have firmware in them that define what regions they can play. I believe most DVD players can actually have the region code changed in the firmware, but it's not that you can just flip and back and forth and say, today I want to be in region 6, and tomorrow I want to be in region 1, and then back to region 6 again. I believe you get a certain number of times you can flip it, maybe it's only even once, and you can just change it that one time. I also believe that there are DVD players out there, like yours, that can be modded to be region-free, meaning your DVD player could play movies from any region. Sounds like your laptop does have region encoding, and it's possible you might be able to override that too, but probably only once, unfortunately, so it wouldn't really help. I got to tell you, basically, the movie companies hate us. That's the bottom line. If you'd like to learn more about this annoying problem, here's a link to an article in Wikipedia on the subject I put in the show notes. Hope that helps, and thanks again for the kind words about Steve's review. Wait, stop the presses. In the live chat room, Zach and Matt both told me about an application called Fairmount from Metakine.com, Metakine.com. The link's in the show notes, so don't worry about writing that down. Anyway, it's a free and open source solution for the Mac that works with VLC, which is the great video player, from videoland.org. It lets you decrypt DVDs, and it also, by doing that, it allows you to flip your region code. But you're still going to be stuck with a limited number of flips. So if you do this on your Mac, you really want to be careful. Make sure it's on the one you want to actually be on when you're done. Now, of course, I do not in any way, shape, or form endorse piracy, and I hope you won't use this to do anything to steal media, because that's what they're doing all this crappy stuff to us for anyway. So we got to be on the up and up if we're going to be indignant when they treat us like this. So anyway, don't steal stuff, but this might actually get you around your problem if you can stand to have it stay flipped to a certain region. So for years, I've been in love with Quicksilver as an application launcher. Now, I'm not one of those power users that uses all of the amazing capabilities of the tool, but for a quick launch, man, it couldn't be beat. It's basically been the first thing I load on every machine I ever have to control because I can't stand not having it there. I did use one other feature that I really liked in Quicksilver. I liked the way I could look up someone in my address book simply by typing a few characters of their name into Quicksilver. You could bring up their name, hit an arrow over like to the phone number, hit a character turn, and it would pop up on screen real big so I could read it across the room to dial a number. Love that feature. Well, Bart has tried to convince me several times that I should simply use the built-in Spotlight for the same thing. But I find it's highly inaccurate at learning what I want, and it shows me all this other extraneous stuff like dictionary definitions of the words containing the characters I typed, or documents and images containing similar words, pretty much everything but the application I wanted it to load. And just forget about looking up somebody's name, that simply doesn't even come up. And did I mention it's slow, too? Other than that, I really like Spotlight for a replacement for Quicksilver. Its only advantage is it's on every machine already, so you can use it if you have to. Well, another application people kept trying to get me to try out was LaunchBar. I remembered using LaunchBar ages ago. Heck, it might even have been in OS 9. Well, anyway, I kept hearing all this yapping about LaunchBar, and I thought, what the heck? I should give it a try, so I could clearly explain why it wasn't nearly as good as my beloved Quicksilver. LaunchBar, from Objective Development at obdev.at, is out there, and you can get a free 30-day trial if you want to give it a try yourself. Well, the first thing I realized is I've never seen LaunchBar before in my life. The application I remembered from the 1980s was a big old ribbon thingy with tabs on it. You had to add applications to the ribbon, you had to organize them by tabs, and then when you wanted an application, you had to click on the right tab first to see what you wanted. I couldn't remember what the application was called, so of course I asked Twitter to help my memory out. About 236 people told me it was LaunchBar. No, it wasn't LaunchBar. Stop it. Then it became a joke because everybody kept telling me it was LaunchBar. Thanks, guys. Anyway, luckily, Steve Stanger, at TMA Steve, of the Mac Attack podcast, was paying attention, and he did remember. It was an application called DragThing from DragThing.com. Now, DragThing might be a great application now, but back in the 1970s when I was last using it, I was not impressed. So all this time, I've been avoiding LaunchBar through no offense of its own. So I started using LaunchBar when I still had Quicksilver installed. That created all kinds of confusion because they had the same keystrokes, so I turned off Quicksilver and I went cold turkey to LaunchBar. Get this, LaunchBar works exactly like Quicksilver. I hit the sequence keys to launch and then a few characters of the application and boom, I'm in business. I was delighted when I tried entering someone's name from my address book, and it instantly opened address book to show their contact information. I gotta tell you, I mentioned how much I like it in Quicksilver, but I've missed it because Quicksilver just stopped doing it a while ago. I don't know if it was a Snow Leopard incompatibility or what the deal was, but it hasn't worked in quite a long time. So I ran along happily for a few weeks just using these two little functions of LaunchBar, and then it occurred to me, I wonder if LaunchBar does more than these two essential tasks. I jumped into the help file, and I was instantly overwhelmed with all the things it could do. I got scared, and I ran away for a few days, but then I got my courage up to see just how much I could actually understand and would continue to use. I'm sure I'm not doing this justice because it does a ton of stuff, but let's just use the go through the nuggets I know I'm going to use right away. LaunchBar can launch a website. Just hit the keystroke to invoke LaunchBar and type something like, oh, I don't know, how about podfeet.com? It fills in all the HTTP nonsense, and it launches the website in your default browser. If you've been there recently, you don't even have to type the whole name out. I typed P-O, and it said Podfeet under the text entry field with a little globe symbol. That frequently means that represents the World Wide Web. Remember when we used to call it that? The World Wide Web? That was a globe. Anyway, so I just hit P-O, I saw it sitting there, and I hit a carriage return, and boom, up comes podfeet.com in my default browser. That was perfectly awesome. LaunchBar lets you perform Spotlight searches too, but I don't think I'll use it for that. Just like I don't use Spotlight for its own searches. I find it's not flexible enough to help me find what I'm looking for. And by the way, when I'm saying I don't use Spotlight, I mean I don't hit, what is it, Command Space and use the little magnifying glass in the upper right-hand corner of my window or of my desktop. Instead, I perform all of my Spotlight searches within Finder windows. In the upper left, in the upper right of every Finder window is a search box. And once you throw in some words there, you get an option to add additional filters. Let's say I have a vague idea of when I created a file. I can search for the name, but I can also filter by the date range. There are approximately a zillion feature filter options, so if you can't find it this way, it's not actually on your hard drive. Anyway, back to LaunchBar. Remember I said I liked how you can access your address book with LaunchBar? It turns out, after you found someone's name in LaunchBar, you can use the right arrow to show additional options for what to do with that information. If you arrow to their phone number, it puts in that giant format on your screen that's available in address book, and like I said, very handy for looking across the room to see the number if you're impaired like me, and you can't remember more than three characters at a time. If you arrow over to their email address and hit the return key, it starts an email to them. Very handy. Let's see, LaunchBar will also let you perform searches using services like the Internet Movie Database, imdb.com. And they sort of teach you how to set up these queries in the index. I got kind of confused why this was in the index, and I didn't really understand what the index is, but I'll get back to that later. Anyway, it got complicated really fast, so I ran away from that section. I bet it'd be really cool if I knew how to do it. Maybe people have set up the search queries for me and I could just paste them in, because the ones they had there in the example I pasted them in, they worked really good. So I think launching IMDb from LaunchBar would probably be enough for me, but it'd be kind of cool if you could do searches right in there. When Bart was trying to convince me that I should use Spotlight for application launching, one of my arguments against it was that you have to use leading letters in the name of the application. For example, to search for disk utility, you have to type disk or dis or dih. In Quicksilver, you can type things like du, and disk utility will be the first result. I tested this in LaunchBar, and guess what? It works exactly like I wanted it to. In fact, in the documentation, they specifically explain that as long as you keep the characters in the right order, you will find the item you need. That's really handy when the thing you're typing maybe has something really common in the beginning of the name, and it's a lot easier if you can put some other characters in there. Now, I mentioned the index earlier, and in the context where I mentioned it, it seemed mysterious of, you know, what I was why I was talking about index, but of course the index isn't mysterious at all. It's a listing of what is being indexed for search via LaunchBar. What I found odd is that even though they say you can use the LaunchBar to find documents, doesn't appear to me that your hard drive is actually being indexed by default. They are indexing a whole slew of stuff out of the box, like address book, calendar, iTunes library, iPhoto library, but not your hard drive. I read some more documentation. Hey, are you proud of me? You catch this whole thing? I'm reading. Anyway, I found you can drag a folder into the left sidebar and it starts indexing it. You can add options and schedule something. Not sure what. I was too lazy to figure that whole part out. Your home directory is actually in the sidebar, but when I looked at the option, the search scope was set to don't search subfolders, but do search for folders themselves. I guess that makes the search times a bit more manageable. You also have the option to access items via subsearch only, which kind of makes sense too. So if I'm looking for an application, I don't really want it searching my entire hard drive and returning all kinds of crapola at the same time. I'd use Spotlight if I wanted that. It's possible that some creative fiddling here, you could start to use Launchbar to find files because they do have categories for filtering. But again, I'm pretty happy with the search and finder windows. That works pretty well for me. All right, bottom line time. Matt gave me the challenge to give this a try and try it out. And I got to tell you, if you liked Quicksilver for its ability to quick launch applications and look up addresses and phone numbers and launch websites, then you really should take a look at Launchbar by using their 30-day free trial over at obdev.at. If you're interested in all of the more advanced features that are way over my head, again, Launchbar is for you. If you're happy with Spotlight for launching applications, then I think the $35 price tag of Launchbar would perhaps be a bit too steep. For me, it's worth it to regain the functionality I lost with the loss of support for Quicksilver. If you've got a household of machines that you control, you might like the Family Pack licensing. They have 5 seats for $59. Again, in my case, I think I'll leave the semi-crippled Quicksilver on the other family machines and selfishly use Launchbar just for me. Until Steve hears this review. Before Bart and I recorded this week's show, he asked me if I would accept Windows 7 questions as dumb questions. I told him that I would certainly accept the questions, but I couldn't promise I could actually answer Windows 7 questions. See, Bart installed Windows 7 for his grandfather. You're going to hear all about it in chit-chat across the pond. And he was having a problem navigating the Windows 7 control panels to figure out how to set the default microphone source. Now, in the normal world, writing a tutorial on this kind of thing would be a nightmare. But all I had to do was pop up Windows 7, launch Screen Steps, since it's cross-platform, of course, and whip out a quick tutorial for Grandpa. I mailed the PDF output over to Bart, who emailed it to his dad, who does the local tech support for Grandpa, and they should be in business soon. I love how Screen Steps can make tutorials that are so professional-looking and teach easily anything you know on Windows or the Mac. Check it out over at screensteps.com by downloading the free 30-day trial. And when you buy it, be sure to use my coupon code, NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off the purchase price of only $40 for the regular version or $80 for the pro version. Well, I'm excited to tell you that I got my hands on a review unit of the Motorola Droid from Verizon, and I've been playing with it for the last couple of weeks. I have to say, I really like it. But let's start from the top, though, shall we? Let's start with industrial design. The Droid has a giant, beautiful widescreen that's crystal sharp. Viewing maps and images on the device is excellent. There's a YouTube application, which I tested for watching online videos, and for some reason, none of the videos showed full screen. I'm not quite sure why that was. It didn't show them full width or full height, so it wasn't really an aspect ratio issue, but for some reason, it didn't interpret the video correctly. I should say, though, that the motion sensor works really well to recognize rotation of the device from landscape to portrait and back. I've noticed on the iPhone, sometimes it doesn't work and you find yourself flipping it back and forth looking like an idiot, but the Droids work flawlessly every single time. The feel of the device is a bit squared off. It has sharp edges. It's not very rounded to fit your hand. I mean, it's not bad, but it isn't like you just go, ooh, that feels nice, like the Palm Pre or something, you know, that's that nice little, like almost like one of those worry stones that's so nice in your hand. For some reason, I find the power button a bit difficult to press. It's sort of recessed behind a ledge on the top, and I don't seem to find it easily. If I look right at it, it's obvious where it is, but for some reason, I have to look at it every single time to try to find it. The device has 4 buttons across the bottom of the bezel, which are very intuitive. There's a back arrow, a list symbol, home, and search. Each of these seem to work very intuitively in every application I used. If you've dug down a few menus deep in an application, the back arrow backs you up a level. If you've got an application staring at you with no obvious menus, hit the list button and menus become obvious. Search works everywhere, Well, there's a shock. It is from Google, the operating system, right? Anyway, I found the consistency of those four buttons extremely pleasing. It just really, really worked well. All right, time to talk about keyboards and typing. The Droid has an on-screen keyboard that works extremely well. I would put it easily on par with the iPhone keyboard in sensitivity and accuracy. The keyboard flips sideways in most applications to landscape mode, and that allows two-thumb typing a little more easily than it does in the portrait mode. In some cases, you get haptic feedback when you touch the keys, when you touch the screen. You get a little vibration under your finger when you touch the screen. An example of that would be when you unlock the screen when you first turn it on, you feel that. Now, they didn't include haptic feedback during regular typing, and I don't think it actually needs it. I have to tell you, the on-screen keyboard beats the heck out of the Storm 2 with that SurePress technology that you know how much I hate. They also did include a physical keyboard, so that adds to the bulk of the device. I mentioned that there's these ledges on the device. Sliding the two halves apart reveals the physical keyboard. I think this will be a selling point of the device for some, but the on-screen keyboard is so good, I kept forgetting the physical keyboard was even there. The keys on the keyboard, on the physical keyboard, are very flat, so it's hard to use without looking right at it, which is one of the main reasons you would want a physical keyboard. I mean, if you have to look at it, you might as well look at the screen, I think. Anyway, the physical keyboard works okay. They're not annoying, but there's just not enough differentiation between the keys to be able to accurately tell where your fingers are. There also is what looks like one of those fingerprint scanners, but I think it's actually a little copper scroller area thingy. In any case, it didn't seem to do anything for me when I ran my finger across it, so I'm not entirely sure what it's supposed to do. I know, I could go look it up, but what kind of fun would that be? Instead, I'm sure a listener will be happy to send me an email or a tweet saying, okay, moron, here's what it's for. On the Storm 2 review I did just a few weeks back, I complained about the algorithm they use to decide how to deal with typos. Luckily, Droid does it the right way. As you type, if you make a mistake, it shows you a list of probable words to choose from. And they are not under your finger where you can't get to them like on the Storm 2. They're easily accessible. If you ignore the options, it assumes it was right with its first choice and replaces your typo with a corrected word. This is, again, perhaps not intuitive, but since there's a much better chance that you misspelled a word than there is that it was wrong, your accuracy goes way up with this method of replacement, and it allows you to fly along on the keyboard happily typing away and assuming that the Droid will simply clean up after you. By the way, this is an option you can turn off if you're some kind of weirdo and don't see the world exactly as I do. I got to tell you, I really miss this auto-correction when I'm on the BlackBerry Bold now. I go to type stuff, and it's like, wait, you just left my typo there? You could just clean that up for me as we were going? What's the big deal with that? You have to teach it everything. I did have a problem with the Droid not realizing that I had closed the physical keyboard one time. It would not give me the on-screen keyboard back. I quit applications and went back in and out of them to try and trigger the on-screen keyboard, but it simply would not give it to me. I shut the device off, and it still wouldn't let me have the on-screen keyboard when I turned it back on. Finally, I powered the device all the way down and restarted it, and only then was I able to get the on-screen keyboard back. It was just a one-time thing out of, you know, hundreds of times I did it, but maybe tens of times I did it. Like I said, I didn't use the physical keyboard very much, so I hope that's not a consistent problem. Personally, I think they should blow off the physical keyboard. But they probably would lose sales if they did that. I think they'll probably get more sales if they keep it. So I'm delighted with the user interface of the application screen. When you first turn the device on, you have a few applications showing. And then there's a little gray box at the bottom with an up arrow on it, just inviting you to drag it up. Do that with a flick of your finger, and you can see all of your available applications in alphabetical order. I know on the iPhone you can put them in any order you want, organizing by category like games versus utilities. I don't really want to do all that work. I kind of like it in alphabetical order. If you see an application in the alphabetical listing, all you have to do is touch and hold on the icon, and it does that haptic vibration and then shows you the home screen. Drag it around to where you want it and then let go. I found again that this was extremely intuitive. I didn't read any manuals or any online help to figure out how to use the Droid. Excellent job on the UI. Well, a big selling point of the Droid is that it comes with turn-by-turn directions built into the Google Maps service. However, this was one place I was not impressed. I did like the maps themselves, For example, you have an option of a sort of angled view that makes it feel kind of 3D-ish, and I really like that. However, the voice was just dreadful. It sounds like the mechanical voices of the 1990s. Not at all good. Now, I could have forgiven the voice quality if the directions had actually taken me to my location. I gave it my home address when I was about, I don't know, 8 blocks away, and it gave me the directions, but it told me I'd reached my destination when I was still a block and a half away. That was entirely unacceptable. I had gotten used to how intuitive and logical the interface was on the Droid when I came across a glaring counterexample, and again, it was in with the maps. If you look up an address, it's reasonably likely that your next move might be to ask for directions to that location. But for some reason, once you ask for a location, if you ask for directions, it assumes you want to go from your current location, but it leaves the to field blank. That was completely lame. Why wouldn't the to field be the field you just searched on? That was stupid. So anyway, I don't know. Oddly enough, the maps were not its best selling point. So I almost forgot to test the actual phone on the Droid. I find the phone to be kind of the least interesting and least used features of my devices these days. But I guess it's important to people, you know, some people anyway. It's important to a lot of people probably, so I thought I should give it a try. I tested out making a call, and then I added another call to make it a conference call. But then I couldn't find the hang-up button. On the iPhone, the hang-up button is always visible unless you're in the keyboard mode, and getting back to the other mode is obvious. But on the Droid, once I had the second call, I only had a big green call button. I eventually pushed enough buttons, so I did find it, but it was a bit of a struggle and kind of random. With everything else so intuitive on the Droid, it was really weird to run into something that was non-intuitive. I think they need to tweak that just a little bit. But the phone, you know, worked, and I was able to add the calls together. All right, time for the bottom line. I think the Motorola Droid is a fantastic device with a superb operating system. I found nearly everything in the interface to be very intuitive and easy to use. The on-screen keyboard is perfection. No issues with it at all. The physical keyboard is unnecessary, in my opinion, and barely adequate, not nearly as good as the keyboard, say, on the BlackBerry Bold. But having the keyboard will probably convince people who are afraid of on-screen keyboards to buy the device, so that's probably a good reason for them to keep it from a marketing standpoint. Adding and moving applications is very easy and, again, intuitive, but the user should use caution because of the severe memory limitations on adding applications. I didn't actually mention that. I should have brought that up. The Droid only has 512 megabytes of RAM in it, and you can only address half of that for applications. Now, you're probably saying, oh, maybe we should, you can stick in a memory card. But it turns out you cannot write applications to that memory card. That's really, really crucial to understand. I loaded a ton of applications, and I wasn't able to fill it up at all. But I really am concerned about how that's really going to work when some big applications like some really fun games are coming along. So watch out for that. One final word of caution. Verizon has instituted an obscene early termination fee on its smartphones. You have to pay $350 to get out of your contract if you buy a Motorola Droid. It's shocking to me. It's a shocking sign that they feel they have to hold you hostage to stay with them. How about just providing good devices with good service? Wow, what a concept. That should work too, right? Now, I know there's no love lost with AT&T right now, but the termination fee, which is still annoying, is $175 on AT&T. So be sure to take that into account when choosing your device. But bottom line, I think the Droid is really hitting the mark. Well, this next section of the show is actually maybe a little self-serving, but I asked the chat room, and they encouraged me to go ahead and talk about this. I may have mentioned it before, but I'm having an issue with my Mac that I'd like to talk through just in case some of you have some ideas for me. As you've undoubtedly heard, I do my podcast live every Sunday night on Ustream, and for ages, months at least, everything was fine. About a month ago, I started having a complete system lockup in the middle of the show. I'd be chattering away, and then I'd realize that nothing was moving on my Mac. The clock wasn't ticking, CPU sensors weren't moving, Ustream wasn't moving, nothing. And my first thought was that the system had overheated, but I watched it carefully the following week and had two cooling mechanisms, so I don't think it was that. I was using the ThermoPack on top of an iLap desk. That ought to be enough. When it died, the CPU was at 88 degrees Fahrenheit, and the processors were going about 70%, which isn't all that out of the ordinary when you're running as many different applications as I am. So I wasn't quite sure. But let's review my setup, which, even if you can't help me, will let you know just how complicated it is to create the live show every week. So first of all, I run an application called CamTwist to pipe the view of my screen plus picture-in-picture from my eyesight on my cinema display. So those two video sources are combined into one output with CamTwist, which then goes into Ustream as a single video source. I do the same kind of thing with audio. I run Audio Hijack Pro to pipe the audio to SoundFlower from my Heil mic via a USB interface and from GarageBand where I'm recording. So now those two audio input sources combine to create one audio input to go into Ustream. At the same time, I'm reading my show notes using Feeder, and I've got Safari or Firefox running to push everything over to Ustream. Finally, I've been using Colloquy to participate in the live chat as an IRC chat client. I know, it's a lot of balls in the air for me and my poor little MacBook Pro. The MacBook Pro is running Snow Leopard, and it's a 2.53 GHz Core 2 Duo with 4 gigs of RAM, plenty of hard disk available. Now, after I ran this past the Mac Roundtable crew and asked them their advice, on Chuck Joyner's advice, I tried rebooting before the show. That worked perfectly for 2 weeks, but then it started locking up again. 1 week we tried a new idea, thanks to Zach in the chat room. We talked about how Colloquy was the last thing I had added, so he gave me a crazy idea of moving Colloquy off to a second machine and then screen sharing over to it. Of course, that week it didn't crash, so we thought things were figured out. The following week, though, I couldn't get screen sharing to work, and I ran Colloquy natively again, and that week it didn't crash at all. So, we have no idea if it made a difference at all. It's not consistent. Unfortunately, Colloquy is the only thing I can really put off on another machine. Everything else has to be in one space so that I can see it in front of me. Now, here's some good news. While I was in Mexico, I got some sad little tweets from the chat room regulars bemoaning the fact that there was no live show. So I thought, heck, I'll just go into Ustream just to say hi. And my system locked up. Now you might ask why this is good news. Well, it's good news because so many things were not running that I normally do run. I was able to eliminate a bunch of variables. That's what's been making this so hard to figure out. With so many applications running, doing so many different things, it's nearly impossible to figure it out. I've thought about calling AppleCare, and I'm thinking, God, they're just going to go, what are you, nuts? You can't do all that at once. Anyway, in this case, since I was away from home and I was actually only going to do chat, I wasn't running GarageBand, I wasn't running CamTwist to combine the video, I wasn't running Audio Hijack Pro to combine the audio, I did not have an external microphone, so my Blue Icicle USB interface and my Heil PR20 mic are not to blame. I happened to be running Chrome that day for some weird reason, so that eliminates Safari and Firefox. And in Safari and Firefox, I run flash blocking plugins, so I thought maybe those were the cause, but they can't be because in Chrome, I didn't have any of those. I didn't even have my external monitor plugged in, so it's not the cinema display itself, and it's not the eyesight within that monitor, and it's not the USB hub that it has. Nothing like that was in there. Now, I was running a few things that can also be eliminated because they can't be the cause because I never run them normally during a live show. I was running Twirl, Adium, Mail, and Launchbar, and Quicksilver wasn't running, but I know that's off the hook because I quit that before too. So none of those things can be it. So with none of my normal applications, that leaves the things I run at startup, which include Zoom 2, Forever Save, Sketch, and Typeinator. Now, I've been running Sketch and Zoom 2 for ages, but they have been revved up regularly, so they're not completely above suspicion. I started thinking maybe Forever Save was the culprit, because it's the last in that series to be added, and it's a rather unorthodox application. You may recall a review I did on it a while back. It allows you to set up autosave on applications so you don't have to remember to save all the time. I don't have it enabled for GarageBand or Feeder, the only two applications that actually require saving, but it seemed that maybe it was trying to interact with something else that was running. Since it saves your files outside of the constraints of the program setting, that could be a problem. Now, I was talking to Bart about it, and he asked me a really tough question. He said, what if it's Ustream itself? Well, I don't know what to do with that if that's true. But then, just a couple of days, or actually today, I had a crash when I wasn't doing Ustream, but I was trying to play a Flash movie. Now, I shouldn't say a crash. This is a lockup. Basically, everything just stops. I don't get a blue screen or anything. Everything just freezes. So I was playing a Flash movie, but I wasn't in Ustream. So then I thought, wait a minute. Maybe it's Flash itself. I checked my Flash version by going to adobe.com/software/flash/about, and I was running 10.0.32.18. I checked Adobe's website, and the latest version is 10.0.42.34. So today I'm giving that a whirl to see if maybe I finally killed off this beast. The good news is that I've narrowed this problem way down at this point, but if anyone has an idea of what else I could eliminate, I'd sure be glad to give some advice on what else to try. The live chat room would be really happy if we ever figure this out. The one thing I would miss, though, is if Kevin and Carell and all the others stop yelling "save" in the chat room every time I pause recording. We've kind of gotten into the rhythm where they have to do that all the time so I don't forget, because they got tired of me hearing me repeat everything over again when I got a system lockup. Anyway, any ideas, give me a holler. I'd sure be curious what you think. Remember I mentioned Carrie and Mike that helped me with the car waxing? Well, they originally came over, like I said, because they just bought an Acura RDX, and Steve has one, and they wanted to compare notes. Within seconds, I was telling them about Honda Bob. Well, you know you have a good mechanic when you find yourself bothering friends, neighbors, and strangers by telling them all about him. How could we not tell everyone about him? He comes to our house, he does all the care and feeding of our Hondas and Acuras, he charges a reasonable fee, he cleans up after himself, tells bad jokes, and of course does a great job in all maintenance and repairs. If you live in the L.A. or Orange County areas, and of course, if you have a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's my favorite time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm cold. Very, very cold.
Guys, we have a north freezing your patooties off out there.
Yeah, we have a north wind that's established itself and is showing absolutely no signs of going anywhere like south, for example, which would be great. No, it's been like -5 to -10 at night, barely peaking over zero during the day and snowing and generally being very ick.
Aww. Snow's really entertaining, like once a year, right?
Snow's entertaining if it's soft and fluffy and not frozen and fun to go frolic in, and then it melts the next day. Snow is not fun if it's hard, frozen solid, and icy and here for 2 weeks.
And traveling horizontally in the wind.
And that too. Yeah, no, it took so long to get home. I left my parents' place yesterday trying to get ahead of most of the bad weather. So we did the whole New Year's Eve thing. And then on New Year's Day, we headed home to try beat the bad weather. And it didn't entirely work, to put it mildly. I think it took we got to Maynooth in what we thought was a very long time, so I think it took us 2 hours instead of 1 hour and 10, and then it took them 3 hours to get home. Back to their place.
Oh, wow.
So, that's, yeah, not good.
Oh, that sounds awful.
But anyway.
Well, you know, it sprinkled here for a day. It was horrible. My car got dirty.
A little bit of drizzle. I'm assuming it wasn't in any solid sort of form. I presume it was liquid.
It was probably... No. Because it was in the 50s.
Yeah, okay. It would be liquid then.
Anyway. All right. So we got any security light this week?
I'm still on my RSS holiday. Nothing caught my attention, but that means very little, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I heard RSS is over anyway, isn't it, Bart?
According to Leo, RSS is history, and it was never all that important to begin with. So the man obviously has no idea how iTunes works and how he's gotten to be so famous. But there you go.
What was the context that you said Leo Laporte said that?
Oh, I was just while I was doing some stuff searching, I was listening to his Decade in Review show, and he had various of his many guests, you know, send in segments and stuff and asking all the people who are on live, you know, what do you think is the biggest invention of the decade? And someone said RSS. Exceptionally astute observation. RSS has completely revolutionized the world in the last decade. And Leo poo-pooed the whole thing, said no one really uses it anyway. I mean, it never really took off. Who uses RSS readers? Well, actually, he said no one uses RSS readers anymore, which made me grumpy anyway. But, you know, and the guy was trying to argue, well, no, it's under the hood everywhere. It's what holds the internet together. And Leo was poo-pooing the whole thing. It was ridiculous. No one cares about RSS. And I thought, God of Almighty, how little understanding do you have of how you got to be where you are?
So he doesn't know how podcasting works at all then.
That
at
the or he's forgotten.
For anybody who doesn't know that, that is the fundamental underpinning of the way a podcatcher works is and a podcast works. That is, without RSS, the show, you would not be listening to the show.
Well, you could be on the website, but if you've subscribed in iTunes or subscribed in anything, then you subscribe using RSS. If you have your Facebook sucking in your stuff from Flickr and sucking in your stuff from your blog, it's all being done over RSS. That's how you syndicate stuff.
Well, I'm glad that other guy was on there anyway.
Yeah, but Leo didn't give him the time of day. He did not really get much chance to make his point.
Ah, phooey.
Yeah, I've been swearing at Leo a lot more than I used to.
Yeah, I don't know what's happened to him. Maybe it's that weird water he drinks. Something's going to his head.
too much with brain tonic or whatever that stuff
brain
is
called. Tonic, exactly. Brain tonic's working the other way. Well, anyway, our main topic, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Logitech MX Revolution because it's a mouse, by the way. It was recommended to me by basically every single member of the Mac Roundtable. I think we had an episode where we were talking about input devices, and every single person said, oh, the MX Revolution, you got to have the MX Revolution. So I asked for one for Christmas, and Santa brought me one.
Yay!
It is. It feels fantastic in the hand. It probably the exact opposite of the Magic Mouse, I think I would say.
The Magic Mouse, strangely enough, also feels fantastic in the hand, but different.
Completely different. Yeah, flat versus
very different.
Big arced thing. I didn't think I wanted a big mouse, but it fits really nicely in the hand. It's got a real bizarre curve. If you're left-handed, you wouldn't like it.
I wonder, do they sell a lefty version?
I don't know. I think most left-handed people
there's a
have
market
adapted.
There.
Well, I think a lot of left-handed people just adapted and said, all right, I'll use my right hand for mousing. I know my son does it that way. But anyway, that wasn't exactly the point, was how exciting Elsa got a new mouse. Wow. What I wanted to talk a little bit about was you had cautioned a long time ago about the Logitech drivers, that there was a big reason not to download them. Why don't you reiterate on that part?
Well, this all came to light in the transition between Tiger and Leopard. So not Snow Leopard, not Leopard to Snow Leopard, but one previously Tiger to Leopard. And there was a whole bunch of reports of mystery blue screen of death, they were called. You'd do the install, the machine would reboot, and then it would hang on the blue screen before it ever put up the login window. And initially, Apple was getting it in the neck for this, until eventually the culprit was traced. The culprit was the application enhancer, which is it Rogue Amoeba or who does that one?
Ooh, I don't remember.
It's one of those big shareware or one of those big companies anyway. But it's an interface that can be used by other developers to get at stuff Apple doesn't want you to get at. It's basically, it's a Haxi, is what they're called. So it's hacking stuff into the kernel that Apple didn't put there in folders Apple's documentation explicitly says not to touch.
Oh.
So of course, Apple assumed that no one has done that.
Oh, I just looked it up. It's from Unsanity.
Unsanity, that's it.
And it specifically has a big yellow box on the page that says Application Enhancer currently does work on macOS 10.5. We're in 10.6, aren't we?
We are 10.6.
Okay, just checking. But maybe they fixed it later. But anyway.
Well, yeah, they did fix it. It wasn't every version of Ape. But Ape as a whole, to me, any bit of software that uses Ape is never going near my machine. And if anyone ever hides the fact that they use Ape, they get a black mark against them for life. And
so
that's what Logitech did.
Ape and Application Enhancer are the same thing.
So yeah, everyone calls it Ape because it's APE, Application Enhancer.
Okay.
Actually, that's not really real. Anyway, that's what everyone calls it, Ape.
So Logitech put it in their drivers but didn't tell people they put it in the drivers?
Yeah, so you install the Logitech drivers and Logitech bundled into it Ape.
Oh.
So they didn't actually bother writing a real driver. They just used Ape. So to me, that's... Well, it's fundamentally wrong. There are proper ways that drivers should be written for OS X, and using stuff that Apple explicitly says not to use is not the right way. So people did not actively install Ape, because initially everyone's response was, well, that'll teach you to install Ape. But it turned out that lots of people had never installed Ape knowingly. Logitech had bundled it into their drivers. So people were just being blindsided by something they just didn't know. They just installed their driver that came with their mouse.
But isn't it a pretty good assumption that Logitech didn't do this, like, you know, for nefarious reasons, that it was a way of getting more access to different features?
No, it's laziness. Rather than having to code your own stuff to interact with the kernel properly, just use someone else's.
Okay.
Well. I've always interpreted it as laziness. Obviously, I can't prove that because I haven't read every line of code in the thing. But it's a shortcut. Everyone else writes their own drivers properly. So why should Logitech do that?
I suppose. Okay.
You know, there's a right way to do things, a supported official way, and there's a wrong way to do it. A large company that charges good money for their products should not do things the wrong way.
I'll give you that.
So now, in fairness, it gave Logitech a lot of bad press. An awful lot of bad press. And I get the impression they have learned their lesson.
So they hung their head in shame and they promised to do better?
I'm not sure I ever saw a blog post where they hung their head in shame or promised anything. But one still gets the impression that the lesson was learned.
Okay.
Because apparently the new drivers no longer contain APE and they're proper drivers.
Ah.
So maybe I'm being too... Maybe I just have too long of a memory. But for me, that black mark doesn't lift. When a company does something that I consider to be that nefarious, the black mark stays in my book.
But you're still in the camp of recommending the Logitech mice.
I do, because they're fantastic hardware. I haven't loaded a Logitech driver in years.
Okay. So they get a black mark, but only in the category for which they made the offensive move?
Yeah, like, it's their software. Their actual physical
hardware guys are okay.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, their industrial design is fantastic. I mean, the Logitech keyboard I have is 5 years old. The thing is perfect.
Hmm.
I haven't even had to change the batteries in it. I don't know how they did that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool.
That just amazes me in itself, actually. So, I mean, their hardware is superb, but their software really annoyed me. So I don't use it, and I don't need it, because the only thing I really want from my mouse is that it interacts with Expose, and Apple give you a way of doing that straight from the control panel that's completely mouse agnostic. So it doesn't matter whose mouse you're using, you can set it up using the Expose tab in the Expose and Spaces sysprefpane pane in your system preferences. Oh, yeah, that was confusing.
So I looked at it, and I wanted more. To me, the fact that there is Expose available to me with a key, you know, the keys. I mean, I just push a little button for things like dashboard, or I use the force fingered swipe up to get rid of everything, and force finger down to get all my windows. I just don't see the need for being able to do that with my mouse, especially since I change machines all the time. I change to work, so maybe that doesn't count. But anyway, my trackpad is always there and my keyboard is always there. Why not just use that? Because there's times it's sitting in my lap. I would sit there going, well, wait a minute, how do I do Expose now? Because I don't have my Logitech mouse with me. So I wanted to do other things with it. Like I'd like to be able to have side-to-side scroll and a few other things, and I'd like to see what it could do. So against Bart's better judgment, I went out to try to do the drivers. So my path was, I figured, okay, everybody knows you don't use the drivers that came in the box, right? Because they're always out of date. So you should just go online.
Sure.
So I typed into Google, I typed Logitech MX Revolution drivers, and no links to Logitech's website were returned. I mean, you know, a whole lot of forums and people bitching about the APE thing and all the stuff where it came up, but there were no links into Logitech's actual site. So I said, well, that's a little weird.
That's some very bad SEO on Logitech's part.
Well, and I'll tell you why. I can tell you exactly why it doesn't work. So I thought, okay, fine, I'll put in the CD. So when I put the CD in, ran the installer, it said, do you want to check for updates? I said, oh, there you go. All right, check for updates. It said, no, there's no new updates. You're good to go. So all right, let me go ahead and install it. And it said, no, this version's incompatible with your OS. Go to logitech.com/Mac for an update. Okay, you
there
just check for update. There isn't one. But it's worse than that. Logitech.com/Mac doesn't resolve. There is no URL. Okay.
Oh, actually, you're invoking a lot of memories, because I actually stopped using the Logitech drivers long before the APE catastrophe.
Okay.
I stopped using them when I couldn't get them to work in Tiger.
Okay.
I couldn't actually get it to map the keys that are physically around my keyboard to be the ones that the Mac reads.
Ah. Well, okay.
Which I thought was retarded. So anyway, I gave up, but that's why I gave up on Logitech software, for experiences like this.
Okay, so I'm thinking, all right, I will go to logitech.com and I'll do a search there. So I found the support pages. It asked me for the model number and I typed in MX Revolution. It said, no, there's nothing on that model number. I'm like, what? It said, oh, mm-hmm. You must find the model number. MX Revolution is not a number. And it says, look on the bottom of your mouse. And, you know, I mean, I am 51 years old and blind, but I got out my glasses, I turned on a light, a bright, bright halogen light, held it under it. I am not kidding you. It's in 1.5 font. It's dark blue on a black background. It took Steve and I combined guessing at what the numbers were to figure out what the model number was. Type that in and then boom, it comes up and says, oh, you mean the MX Revolution. Here it is. No wonder there's no SEO on it. They don't even have it. It's not even on their own site that way. So anyway, I was able to download the drivers, and actually, I'm really glad I did. We'll see whether it causes some catastrophe later. Oh, I should mention, I tweeted and asked, is that ape thing still there? And Michael King assured me that the ape thing was gone, and another guy, I forget who the other person was, also tweeted back and said, I've been using them for a while and everything seems good. So I didn't go in completely blind against Bart's better judgment. But right off the bat, I noticed a really, really interesting thing that the drivers allow you to do. The coolest thing about the MX Revolution is that the wheel has momentum, and it's not one of those crunchy ones, you know what I mean, where it goes as you scroll it. I hate those. And I was playing around with the driver, and all of a sudden the scroller started going, and I was like, what the heck? It turns out you can turn that on and off with software. It's a mechanical. Like, it's mechanically changing the way my finger is, you know, I mean, I can feel like little gears have been put into place, the ratcheting, and it can turn that on and off in software.
You see, okay, MX Revolution is more of a family of mice than anything else. So I have a different mouse that is also part of the Revolution family. Mm-hmm. I think mine is an LX800
Maybe Revolution. That's why I needed that number, you know.
So mine has the spinny wheel with the momentum, mm-hmm. but obviously mine's a slightly older model because at the bottom I have a switch, a physical hardware switch that allows me to go from click, 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 click to the infinite spinning.
Now that makes sense that a physical switch could do it. The idea that you can do it in software. I mean, it is changing. If I click a button, it does something else in software, but it's physically changing. There's even a switch where you can say, use the ratcheting when you're in something like, say, you're flipping through a slideshow or a presentation. You might want to have distinct clicks, right? You don't want to use the momentum and go, whee, and all of a sudden you just flip through your whole presentation. So it flips back and forth between those automatically. It knows what you're on. So on a web page, you'd want to be able to have the momentum, but not in a presentation. That's really kind of cool.
That implies there's some sort of hardware in there, a moving part.
That's being... you've got a moving part too.
Yeah, the spinny wheel. It's bad enough to have one moving part. I like to get rid of them all, which is why I love the Magic Mouse, actually, because there's none.
There you go. It's got buttons for everything. I have been able to get it to do... One of the things I wanted it to do was to scroll horizontally left and right using the thumb wheel. And right now, the thumb wheel forward gives me expose, and thumb wheel backwards gives me a different expose. So I gotta mess around with that. I think that I might be able... I don't know.
My thumb wheel... I don't have a thumb wheel. I only have the wheel on top. Mm-hmm. And the wheel on top can be tilted left and right on mine, and that is your left and right scrolling.
Yeah, I've got that. That's really clumsy, though.
I didn't even know it was there until you mentioned it, but then I noticed the arrows painted on the mouse, so I gave it a go.
Yeah.
I don't use it, clearly.
It's icky. And so I wanted the thumb wheel forward and backwards to do it. I thought that would be real natural because my thumb's right there and just go, right, you know, just like you do with your index finger. But the assigned action options do not include horizontal scroll, which kind of pissed me off. So I don't know, but there's about 8,000 settings I can mess with here. So I'm pretty sure pretty soon I won't even be able to right click anymore with it.
You'll have accidentally set it to be make the tea.
Right. Well, that's probably enough about mice and drivers. I mean, we can even make that be an interesting topic, Bart.
I'm not sure it'll be interesting long.
Well, we thought it was fun. Anyway, we wanted to also talk about tech New Year's resolutions, because I think you have a couple in mind.
Well, I have one in mind for me that I think is just, I'm just going to have to do this. And if I say it publicly, then I have to do it even more.
Ooh.
But I need to get a handle on my inbox. My inbox is a disgrace. There's 174 unread items in there at the moment, and they're so far up I can't even see them.
No.
They're like probably from March or something stupid.
Now, why do you have so much email? Is it you just don't read it?
The modern world barfs email at everyone.
What does?
The modern world barfs email at people. And then I have about 5 different email accounts and stuff. So I don't think, even with the best of intentions, I could ever quite make inbox zero. But I think I'm going to do 1/7 of that and make it so that every Friday evening, I don't leave work or do anything interesting until my inboxes are all at zero.
Oh, so this is your work email that's such a mess?
Oh, all of them.
Email? All of them? All of,
the IMP email, my personal email, my personal business email, my work email. There's another one here somewhere. Oh, for some reason I have a Gmail too. They're all just a mess.
Well, what are you going to do to make yourself get to that? Just committing
just
to it?
Disciplined. I'm just going to have to be disciplined. Yeah, I used to, about 5 or 6 years ago, I used to do that. Every Friday afternoon. You know, that sort of lull period between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock when you don't want to start any new projects because, well, it's 5 o'clock and you're not going to start anything complicated now.
See, I'm always afraid at work if I open something on a Friday night at 4 o'clock, it's going to be something asking me to do something. And then once I've opened it, I'll forget to do it unless I do it right then. So I'll see an email that I can tell has action in it and I'll skip right over that one and do something easy like, you know, delete some spam or something.
That's the other thing, of course, is I tend not to... Yeah, a lot of them are from Flickr and stuff and things like, oh, I must go back and look at that person's photo stream later. Mm. Well, it's now 7 months later. Maybe I won't.
I had a...
Maybe I need to filter more of them into subfolders and then just do bulk deletes in them every week. So, yeah, whatever I haven't looked at yet from Flickr is gone.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I had a process going for a while at work. I used to get in my old job, I was getting, 70, 80, 100 a day. And I would say probably half of those were somebody asking me to do some. And it was unmanageable. And then, so I got this great idea. I thought, you know what? I'm going to filter any email where I'm CC'd into a separate mailbox. That way, if I have time, I'll go over and glance at those. But if I'm CC'd, you know, everybody else is on distribution too. It's probably not that big of a deal. But if it's to me, that's probably somebody asking me to do something.
And makes at the sense.
It was a big mistake. It turned out back then, meeting notices were CCs. So I was missing meetings right and left. So
yeah, filters are good, but be careful, I guess, is the moral of that story.
Yeah, pay attention. I do it completely wrong. My email is my to-do list, just like they say not to, you know, the getting things done people.
Okay, I kind of do that too, but I use the flag. So if it's flagged, that means I have to do it, and I have them sorted by flagged. So as far as I'm concerned, my inbox starts below the flagged items.
Yeah.
And there's never more than one screen of those because I'm not that bad at doing things.
I just keep it unread. Or worse yet, I open it.
Yeah, no, that's why I say flag them and then sort by the flags. That way all the flagged stuff is right at the top in your face all the time.
I got to see, wait, how many mail items do I have open? See, I keep these things open and that means I'm supposed to do something. I think there's about 8 of them open right now. And I do it because it irritates me.
That's actually a good technique to get stuff done. Irritate yourself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And putting stuff on the desktop. I hate having a messy desktop. So if it's on the desktop, I'm like, get that thing done. So you have another resolution, but it's not for you. It's you're telling other people what they should resolve to do.
It's my suggestion if you're thinking of what will I try to do to make my online or my cyber life a little more organized this year. My suggestion is to tag your photographs as and when you deal with them rather than leaving it until some future later that will never happen.
Ah.
Because that way you can do things like, you know, when someone says to you, oh, do you have any photos of your cousin Kevin? You can just get the photos of your cousin Kevin rather than spending an hour scrolling through everything, which is what I ended up doing yesterday. It wasn't my cousin Kevin, but we were at my dad's and one of our other relatives was around and said, like, oh, yeah, you must have some photographs of so-and-so. And Dad was like, oh, yeah, I do. But he has like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos, probably hundreds of thousands of photos. Mm. And so it took, you know, forever scrolling through every event, scrubbing through them all, going, oh, there's one, and oh, no, there's another one, and then trying to get them all together onto a CD to give to the person.
Isn't that what
it was?
Faces
a lot more difficult.
I thought Faces was supposed to solve all that.
That's a good point, actually. I forgot that. Yeah, I'm not used to having. I don't have the latest iPhoto, so it doesn't come into it for me.
Right, right.
But not just places, but you know, not just faces, but you know, various things. You often want to be able to just find something. Like, you know, pictures of your granny in Spain.
Right.
You know, it's if you tag them as you go, it just makes your life so much easier in the future.
I'm really good about naming my photos. I don't actually use tags so much. I have started to use tags basically just for Steve and I and Lindsay and Kyle. I always tag those with our names so that I can possibly get to them easier. But I've got, I'm pretty darn good about typing in names for them. It was a little tough when we went to Mexico where it was like whale, 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 really big whale, whale jumping, whale tail. You know, so I don't think I named all of those.
That's sort of pseudo tagging anyway, because it does make it searchable. So if you were to search for whale, they would all show up, even if they weren't tagged.
Right.
Because the searchers will search the names as well as the descriptions as well as the tags.
Right.
Unless you tell them not to, of course.
Yeah, so either way, I think your advice is good. It does make a big difference. It makes your photos a lot more fun if you can actually find things in them.
Yeah. So that's my tip to other people, because it's something I do very, very, very diligently, perhaps to the point of pedanticism, but I'm not suggesting everyone should have quite as many tags as I do, because since Aperture lets you nest your tags, I have, like, ridiculous many tags.
And most of them have the word butterfly in them?
Well, no, butterfly, you see, has sub-tags for every species.
And then there's the Latin ones, right?
Well, no, I put them English and Latin together in one tag. So it's English name bracket Latin name as a tag.
Of course it is.
Of course it is.
All right. Hey, we thought we might have time to squish another topic in here. You installed Windows 7? Is that
not
right?
Not for me. Oh. Yeah, not for me. Although I did install it for me in a VM at work, but I haven't used it at all. I just installed it, went, oh, look, it's in the VM. Great. Turn off the VM. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming I'm going to need it at some stage in work to test stuff. So it's just kind of there. But the one, as is the norm when I go home, it's, you know, family tech support time. That's what holidays are.
Mm-hmm.
So I got summoned to my grandfather's. It's like, right, I've been reading all this stuff about Windows 7, and I want to give it a go because it looks cool.
Now, is this a VM or he's on Windows?
His machine's dual boot. So he had XP and Ubuntu, and he was starting to use Ubuntu more than XP. But I got the impression the Ubuntu was grating with him a bit.
Okay.
So he decided he wanted to go to Windows 7 because that would solve all of his problems. But still keep the Ubuntu for internet banking and stuff, which is good. I'm glad he suggested that.
Okay.
Because I certainly would have. So, you know, down to the computer shop, bought Windows 7. That was great. €129 for home premium. Ooh. As a Mac user, I just feel gouged. But there you go.
Let's see, so what is that in our dollars? That's $184. Yeah,
we have to pay more. Microsoft.
That's a single license, right? That's single seat.
Single seat.
Which version did you get him?
That's an upgrade. That's a single seat upgrade from Windows XP to home premium.
Home premium. Wow. Yikes.
Yeah, I wasn't particularly impressed. I also did a bit of other bits and pieces while we're at it. So we got him an actual external mic instead of using a headset because he uses Skype a lot. And we got a little splitter so that the signal from his sound goes to both his headphones and his speakers at the same time. So he doesn't have to plug stuff in and out. He just turns the speakers on and off and it doesn't matter if the headphones are going.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I suppose you might wear out your headphones.
Yeah, they're cheap.
Okay.
Yeah, the headphones are really only just there in case if he's Skyping, the echo gets too bad. Skype's noise cancellation usually works okay, so people can get away without it. Because he doesn't want to use the headset, because that way him and my grandmother can't Skype together.
Oh, right, right.
So by having the mic and having the speakers, the two of them can be on Skype together.
Oh, neat.
And it's just if it becomes a case that the echo's too bad, then they can pop on the headphones, or one of them can.
Nice. So, back to Windows 7.
So I went to install Windows 7. The first thing that struck me, actually, is that the installer's gotten very nice.
Yeah, not bad.
Well, if you think to the old Windows installers, where it was the yellow text on yellow and white text on the blue background, I mean, that still persisted at least to XP, if not further. I never installed Vista, so I don't know what Vista had. But, you know, the Windows 7 one is a nice GUI installer. Doesn't ask you too many questions. It just kind of works. It's nice.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with it.
So that was a pleasant surprise. Then it came to the serial number bit. And that's still a ginormous pain in the backside, even worse than I remember, because it seems to have gotten longer.
Yeah, it's more characters than there are molecules on Earth, I think.
Oh, so then he's not quite 80 yet, but he's my late 70s grandfather with poor eyesight and poor light trying to read out the number.
Oh, nice and
took
slow
us a few goes.
For you, right?
It took us a few goes. And as a Mac user, that just grates on me so badly. It's like I've had to pay 130 versus 30, so I've had to pay four times as much and a little bit more. And now I have to do this crap as well. it just grated on me very badly. It didn't go down well. Anyway, so then I got it up and running, and it was mostly fine. I mean, it worked, but my granddad likes to have things the way he likes to have things. So I need to go and tweak a few things.
Okay.
And the first thing, which I didn't believe him at first, because I did this over a couple of days because his internet is quite slow. So we installed it, got it updating, and then I went home and then I came back the next day and he went, you know that iTunes doesn't play any music? And I was like, what? And sure enough, double click on something in iTunes and no sound whatsoever comes out of the speakers.
Really?
But the system sound was working fine and Skype was working okay. So what on earth was going on? I still have no idea why, but for some reason Windows had a default sound device which was different than the sound device it used for the system.
So,
or maybe it sends system sounds to every sound device or something.
Huh.
So system sounds worked, Skype worked because I told it what device to use.
Right.
But no other program on the computer could make noise.
Hmm.
So eventually, now this is so hard, because the control panels in Windows are, it's a maze. And at no point do you have any clear idea where you are in the hierarchy, because I'm not sure there even is a hierarchy. There's sometimes it's what you need is in the sidebar, sometimes it's a heading, sometimes it's a subheading. When you go into it, you can't get back to where you came from. I get so, so lost in a sea of text and confusingness. I hate the Windows control panel setup.
I have to give you this one. Just spend some time in the network control panels. That's really fun.
Well, the 20 million of them.
Right. And you'll go in these circles where you're going, wait a minute, I think I was here before. And then you want to get back to there where you were before, only you can't find that one again because now you need it.
And you're constantly getting these little breaks from, oh, I recognize that from Windows XP. That's a Windows XP dialog box that snuck in there. Oh, I recognize that one from Vista. Oh, I think I've seen that one in Windows 3.1. And at no point is there any sort of coherent logic to it. It's a mess. Eventually, I managed to get the sound card set up so that the right audio device was the system, was the default, and then everything just worked, and iTunes was fine, and all was well. Then, the next day, I found out that Skype kept on forgetting which sound input to use, and I'm assuming it's exactly the same problem. Only I can't remember how I managed to tell the system which sound device to use for output, and I can't find out how to do it on input now. So I still haven't got that solved.
So that's
but I'm
within
assuming
Skype.
It's there somewhere.
That's within Skype?
Well, no,
or
I think
within...
No, Skype keeps doing whatever the Windows tells it to do, and Windows keeps telling it the wrong thing. So every time you restart Skype, it's not using the correct mic.
Okay.
And that's because the Windows system... Because when you go through Windows system and you try to tell the Windows system to do an audio test, it doesn't work either.
Oh. Now, he's got more than one input? If his mic's
Windows is seeing two.
Okay.
Windows is seeing there being two microphones. I have no idea what else it's seeing as being a microphone, because as far as I'm concerned, there is just the one.
Well, maybe
I don't know what
maybe
it's
he's
seeing.
Got an internal mic. Maybe there's an internal mic and he's got an external mic plugged in.
It's a PC, though.
we can talk
and shout as much as we want, and this other mythical mic source picks up nothing.
Oh, okay. All right. So if it were the internal mic,
silent.
It would do something.
Yeah, we'd expect it to find something somewhere. So no, and I haven't figured that one out. And like I say, I eventually found it for the other audio after much going around in circles, and I never quite got back to there. Or the equivalent for input, which is where I really needed to go. So that really annoyed me.
Well, before
the
we get started, Bart asked me whether I would accept dumb questions on Windows 7. I said I would accept them. Whether or not I could answer them would be another trick. But I'll go into my Windows 7 machine and see what I can figure out.
Yay! Because that is my dumb question then. The other thing, my grandfather doesn't like having to enter a username and a password, and every other OS we've ever used allows you to set up an auto login. I do it for him on Ubuntu, did it for him on Windows XP. I could do it for him on the Mac if only he'd bought one. Not on Windows 7, you don't.
You know, I'm not a fan of auto login. I really am not. I just have so many examples of where, you know, my father-in-law will call me and say, hey, we can't get into our mail. I had to reinstall. I don't know what my password is. If you're forced to do it all the time, you don't forget what it is. And it auto-fills in your username, so all you have to do is type in your password.
Yeah, but he's set in his ways. As far as he's concerned, it's all a complete distraction. He really doesn't care about that kind of stuff. He just wants his PC just to be there, you know. So I can understand that. And as far as I'm concerned, I would never make the decision to use auto-login.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a valid decision for people to make. So eventually, after some Googling, there's a command line hack you can do to bring up a hidden dialog box, which is actually the dialog box from Windows XP, which will allow you to set the auto login, just like you could on Windows XP, because it is actually the Windows XP dialog box again.
So you got it to
Windows
work,
7
huh?
for the crack. So I got it to work, but only with some Googling and some command line hackery. I don't know, it's ridiculous.
Now, there's got to be some stuff you like about it.
Ah, yeah, the sudo doc is actually exceptionally cool. The whatever you call the new taskbar. In fact, I'd go so far as to say it's better than the doc.
No, but...
No, I'll tell you why.
I'll tell you why you're wrong.
Okay, but the doc only shows you whether or not a program is on or off. That's the only clue you get from it. Whereas on Windows 7, you see what's on because it has a box around it, and if something is on and has multiple windows, it has a double box around it. So you can not only tell that I have a Firefox window open, you can tell I have multiple Firefox windows open. Then you can hover over it to see them all and click on the one you want. So actually, I find that it works very well. I can pin stuff, I can move stuff around.
Try pinning a document. You can't.
Okay, but it's only an application launcher, I guess.
No, it pins a folder, but it will not pin documents, individual documents.
I don't think I've ever pinned a document to the dock in my life since macOS 10.3.
Well, that's because we have the sidebar, the Finder sidebar windows. That works a little bit better.
I only stick folders in there because,
I have a few documents, just like two or three that I got to get. If I want to get in and out of it every day, I'd really like to be able to pin it, but you can't.
Oh, the other thing is the search actually seems to work pretty well, too.
Yeah, search is way more better. And there's, I did a thing, did I post that? There's a lot of tricky little things you can search, ways you can search. Like you can say, like item colon, or, you know, type colon Excel or something like that. There's little keyword things you can do in there that are not obvious.
Yeah, which is, again, the problem OS X has. Because in OS X it's kind colon PDF, for example.
Yeah.
You know, the search, I needed to find one thing and I'd found it. And I thought, okay, well, thank you for that. Something.
Well, that would be 100% more than you ever found in XP, right?
Actually, before we did the reinstall of Windows 7, I had to find some stuff on his XP machine to back up for him. I tried star.jpg. Didn't find it.
Oh, I love it. That's good. Yeah, I remember the...
But there was a little doggy there telling me he was going to help me out.
Well, at least I had the doggy. I remember when I first started using Windows and I tried to do search and I thought, well, I just must not understand how this works. And all my friends just giggled uncontrollably at my naivete that I thought I could search.
Yeah, not happening. No, it actually took me a very, very long time to find his photos and save them because they weren't in the default location. So I went into the My Pictures folder and it was empty. I was like, no!
Oh, granddad, come on.
Because they're on a different hard drive or a different partition. But anyway, I found them in the end. But then I found them and I zipped them. And then I rebooted the machine and I was going to pull the zip file into Ubuntu. And then I realized that he had a big thumb drive sitting there. So I thought, I'll just put it on the thumb drive. So I rebooted the machine, went back into Windows to get the zip file, and I couldn't remember where on earth I'd found
it. Oh, no.
So I went, okay, this is easy. I'll just look for star.zip.
Yeah, this is another case of where Windows 7, I'm not certain if it's good or not. It's just, it's so much less annoying that you just go, oh, it's fantastic. You know, it might be good on its own, but it's hard to tell.
Such a relief.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was good. And the other thing that's great for my grandfather is that the built-in games have all gotten a great revamp.
Oh, I didn't even know there were built-in games.
There's a great Mahjong game, which is lovely, or Mahjong, or whatever you pronounce that. And the Solitaire app has gotten a facelift. It's actually quite nice. And Minesweeper has gotten a nice facelift. So that's nice. Because one of the things he liked best about Ubuntu was the Mahjong game. So he has that in Windows 7 now.
So he paid, what did I figure out, $250, $280 to be able to play Mahjong faster, better, prettier?
Pretty much.
Is he happy?
But still. Yeah. Yes and no. Until we get the Skype problem fixed, he's exceptionally grumpy. Because the actual words he used was, nothing works, the computer just doesn't work. And I thought, oh goodness, it's exploded. But he eventually managed to figure out it was just that Skype wasn't picking up the input.
That's such a classic user response. Nothing works.
You see, the actual main use of the computer is for him to keep in touch with his family in Belgium. That's the computer's biggest function in life.
Oh.
So when Skype doesn't work, it is a big deal. But it's not nothing works. It's broken. Still.
Oh, I like it. Well, it might be interesting over time to hear how Granddad does with Windows 7.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the pattern shift, because he was never particularly happy with he liked Ubuntu better than XP, but at the same time, I always felt there was a bit of friction there. And so the XP almost never got booted.
Oh.
But I think the tables are going to turn a bit, and I think that the Ubuntu is going to be booted for special occasions like internet banking and stuff. And I get the impression Windows 7 is probably going to win out for general use.
Ah, well, that'll be interesting to see. We'll keep an eye on.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, sorry, one more thing I hate about Windows, but it's been the same since like Windows 3.1, so maybe no one mentions it anymore. What happens if you have a dual boot machine and you install Windows?
When you boot up, you have to tell it which one?
Oh, no. No, no, no. Windows just deletes your boot record and only gives you an option to boot into Windows. It'll find other versions of Windows for you. You can't boot into your Linux install.
Oh, really?
It just paves over the entire master boot record, arrogantly puts itself in, and doesn't even bother its backside to link to the others.
Oh, that's nice.
That's delightful. So I had to reinstall Ubuntu as well.
Oh, had he saved anything in there that you lost? Or?
Well, no, because I reinstalled it over itself, so his home directory was still there, and because Linux keeps all of your preferences in your home directory, like OS X does, and not like Windows in the stupid registry, everything was exactly as he'd left it. His icons were in the same place. All of his shortcuts that he dragged and dropped into the menu bar thing in GNOME were all still there. All of his preferences were there. All of his bookmarks were there. Everything was exactly as he left it.
Cool.
So
well,
thank goodness for that.
Well, let us know how that works over time. I would be curious whether Ubuntu wins out or Windows 7.
Windows 7.
It depends on whether we get Skype working for him, right?
Skype is going to be the key. If Skype works well and friction-free, then it's going to win. The other thing that was a bit of a disappointment is Skype on Windows looks very, very, very different to Skype on the Mac and Skype on Linux. It's like completely different design.
Right.
So that didn't go down well either.
Oh, so he didn't, but wasn't he running it on Windows before?
No, he always ran Skype on Ubuntu.
Oh, I see. But it's supposed to be better on Windows. Has more cool features. It's different.
The interface is exceptionally cluttered. Oh. I suppose it's right at home on Windows. Maybe that's it.
Looks perfectly normal. All right, well,
no, I think Windows users think that if there's not a lot of buttons, the program doesn't do anything. So if you want to show people that we have a full-featured program, you give them a barf interface full of clutter, and they go, see how powerful it is.
Whereas on the Mac side, it's more rewarding for the simple yet elegant interface, right?
Exactly. You don't have to go and tell us that you have lots of features. We'll figure it out. Thank you.
Well, on that note, I'm going to cut us off here, Bart. It's been lovely talking to you as always, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Talk to you again next week, and I'd meant to say it at the start of the show, but our intro got a bit long. Happy New Year to all of the listeners, and until next week, happy computing.
Well, that's just about enough NoSillaCast, I think. I hope you enjoyed the show, because I really had fun. I got to tell you, I love the live chat during the recording. It's not so lonely anymore. I'm not just sitting alone in my room talking to myself. Having an audience there is really fun. You should really come over and join us sometime. It's a really friendly crowd. They're very, very welcoming. If you're not busy next Sunday at 5 p.m. GMT-8, head on over to podfeet.com/live, and you can watch me build the show and join in the live chat. Don't forget, if you're going to Macworld Expo in February, be sure to send me an email, and I'll give you write privileges to the group calendar. And if you have dumb questions, comments, praise, or even the occasional complaint, shoot me an email over at allison@podfeet.com. Oh, be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.